Hello and welcome to issue 47 of Double Reel, the monthly magazine podcast for the discerning film nerd. It's March 2024 and award season reaches its crescendo and the air is alive with the promise of spring. We're here to help you get through the month with a big helping of cinematic content for your waiting ears. My name's James Adamson and I'm a film nerd with a geeky love of film and obscure stories from the world of cinema and a lot of opinions. Joining me on the podcast is my co-host, also called James Adamson. Welcome, James.
Hello, it's good to be back. We've got a good episode coming up.
We aim to provide you with the podcast equivalent of the monthly film magazines you used to buy in the newsagent, packed with a range of features from the world of film. We divide each monthly issue into four parts, which we release a week at a time to keep your feed fed through the month.
This is the first part of the episode, Double Reel Monthly. We'll look at recent film news, what new releases are heading our way, and review any new films we've seen since the last episode. We'll also discuss how we're getting on with the film-related resolutions we've made for 2024.
We'll shortly be releasing our next installment, the Penalty Shootout Film Quiz. Next week, we'll deliver our regular features, Classics and Recommended, Hidden Gem, The One That Got Away, and the remake Hate Watch.
The following week, it will be The Big Conversation, where we talk about a topic from the world of film in more detail. We'll tell you more about that later, and there are more details about all of our features on our various social media channels.
If you want to check that out or comment on the podcast, you can find us on Twitter on @DoubleRealFilm. There's also an Instagram account called Double Reel Podcast and a Double Reel Podcast Facebook page for you to follow if you're that way inclined. You can follow us on letterboxd.com/doublereel, where we list all the films we've discussed on the podcast and much more besides. You can also find the Double Reel Podcast on the new social media platforms Blue Sky, Threads and Mastodon. If you like the podcast, we'd also be very grateful if you could leave a review on Apple, Spotify or whichever platform you use, as it really helps us get the word out to the rest of the world.
Now it's time to dim the lights and take your seats for our latest Double Reel Monthly. Hope you enjoy it.
Let's get into it. Double Reel Monthly is the first part of the episode and gives you a regular digest of news, new releases and how we've been fitting in movie watching with our busy, exciting lives. In the next hour and a bit, you'll get a breakdown of what's going on in the world of film this month that will set you up for your own movie watching. As well as that, at the start of each year, we make some film-related New Year's resolutions, so we'll be discussing the goals we've set for ourselves in 2024. As always, our mission is to give you a great discussion about films and film-related stories that will inspire you to escape the confines of the algorithm and watch something you haven't seen or have been meaning to see for a better cinematic experience. Also, just to quickly mention our other podcast, which you might like to check out. The Adamson's Verses is where we step away from the world of film and talk about stories, news, and anything else that's caught our attention. Our most recent episode, The Adamson's Verses, The Dog Poo Detectives, is out now. With that piece of self-promotion out of the way, let's look at some messages we receive from listeners. Tony, friend of the pod, gets in touch, reacting to the news we touched on last month of a Rogue Trooper film going into production from the 2000 AD comic stable. Tony says, I had some issues with Rogue Trooper in the comics, mostly the fact that he's carrying the consciousness of three of his dead comrades around with him on chips. They talk to him and they're named after the accessories they're stored in, Helm, Gunner and Bagman. If they're doing 2000 AD characters, I'd rather they did ABC Warriors rather than Rogue Trooper and his philosophical backpack. We'll be talking about the new film Dune Part 2 later, and Joe says, I thought it was absolutely amazing. I think the right calls were made regarding changes from the book. Obviously, a lot was missed out, but if you wanted to do a true adaptation, you're talking about four films or more. Nick says, loved it, especially the sound design. The bass that kicks in when they do the voice goes right through you, and when they arrive the sandworms, it felt like a freight train was going past my seat. Better than Part 1, and possibly one of the best films we've ever seen. Adzi, on the other hand...
Oh, fuck off, sorry.
I think people get quite excited when a film's just come out, and also there's some really big fans of the book.
Sorry, not to take away your enjoyment, but Christ.
Adzi says, this wasn't really for me. I thought the first part was okay, but not great. I heard such good reviews of this one that I went along, but I wasn't that fussed. The main villain doesn't turn up till halfway through. I found the story confusing, not to mention how every character seems to have at least three names. All very well put together, but I didn't really enjoy being in that world, so not for me. We'll also be discussing a new sort of indie British film called The Kitchen. And Lammy says, interesting idea, basically a dystopian futuristic London council estate. And I enjoyed Ian Wright being in it. That's Ian Wright, the footballer. But no more than okay. Dan enjoyed it more. Really good stuff. Low budget sci-fi with a biting political message. Thought it was well acted and conveyed a sense of hope and community in The Kitchen itself, despite besides all the plot action. It drops off a bit in the second half, but it's worth watching. We will also be discussing the much maligned Madame Web. And CF says, not as bad as they're saying, but still utter tosh. It starts all right, but goes downhill quickly. Anthony says, what the fuck did I just watch? Madame Web was bound to be hopeless. It's a minor character that doesn't work without Spider-Man. It's a director who doesn't know how to make this kind of film. A writer's room full of the flops who made such a mess of the other films in this universe like Morbius. It's lame, the action is weak, and the villain is atrocious. Sony should just give the IP back to Marvel. Pretty scathing takedown there.
To be honest, picking between Sony and Marvel at the moment isn't really. I know, yeah, choice,
it's
it?
Frying pan and fire, isn't it, for yeah. For a superhero character? My women directors resolution film is Nomadland, in keeping with our Asian cinema, in keeping ish with our Asian cinema theme of the month. And Scott says Nomadland is yet another of those films that I appreciate far more than I enjoy. Bucking the trend, I'm fairly prepared to admit that I thought the film was boring, unworthy of its awards, and personally speaking, my least favourite Best Picture Oscar winner of the 21st Ooh. Century. Tam, on the other hand, says, it's true, it won't be for everyone. I did feel it was my cup of tea because I love movies that focus on the characters and you get to experience what they experience. The scenery was just beautiful to look at and the score really enhanced the film as well. So we'll be going into that later. Thank you very much for all your messages. It's always great to hear from you. This pod is all about, you know, even though the audience isn't huge, it is about connecting with you, you know, and talking about films and connecting about films. So it's amazing to hear from anyone who's got anything to say. Okay, now for the news. Full disclosure, we're a couple of weeks ahead of when we're actually going to be releasing the podcast, just so that we can schedule recording in and everything. So this won't be the latest up-to-the-minute headlines. But anyway, James, what's the news on the street as far as you're concerned?
I don't think anything happened over the weekend, did it?
That was quite quiet, wasn't it? Quite quiet in the film industry.
Happened. Just kidding. It's Oscar season. Oscar season's just finished.
Yeah. It's sort of a big crescendo. It's a big... it kind of caught me out, and I think it caught out a lot of people in America as well, that the ceremony was on quite early. So it actually started as I was getting ready to go to bed on Sunday night. Normally I go, all right, well, the Oscars are... I'm not staying up all night for the Oscars. I'm not going to see anything good.
Catch Best Supporting Actor.
But by the time I'd gone to bed, they'd already given out like two awards. So I think they started earlier, didn't they?
Yeah, so obviously we're going to dissect this in the big conversation, but...
Yeah, we'll keep our powder dry a little bit. Yeah, but yeah, so there's obviously a few headlines, isn't there?
I came home from work and... was like, well, I'll catch Best Supporting Actor, but they did it the other way around. It was Best Supporting Actress.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not going to tell any of the awards. We'll just talk, maybe touch on the films that did well, and we'll kind of get into that, mm-hmm. you know, a couple episodes, a couple reels later, I suppose. But, yeah, I stayed up for the whole thing because I was obviously late, but it was 2:30. Now, I swear the Oscars used to go until about 5 in the fucking morning before.
Yeah, I think... I think it did. It's possible that the Sky had it on a bit of a delay because Sky used to have the rights and I think they put it on a delay and it started earlier. I think it started at something like...
3 p.m. LA time.
Yeah, and then... So that's kind of early evening on the East Coast. And I did hear stories of people being caught out. There was another podcast I listened to, an American film podcast, saying that a friend of theirs was going over to their elderly mum and dad's to watch the Oscars together. And they said, oh, it starts at 4 o'clock. And I said, well, I'm never going to get there in time. I'm getting there for about 5:30. So it's caught everybody out how early it was.
Yeah, so I think we'll discuss the awards and the big kind of... the big conversation, but... I just wanted to touch on the ceremony. So I actually missed the opening monologue. I came home from work and had a bite to eat. And I thought, oh, I'll try and catch a little bit of the Oscars. And I'd missed the opening monologue and Best Supporting Actress had been announced. And I was like, oh, fuck.
Yeah.
But it was fair play to the Oscars given how fucking shite their ceremonies have been and how disastrous the Will Smith slap was. And last year was a bit lame.
Yeah.
Not just in terms of who they gave the awards to, but just the ceremony itself.
Don't offend anyone. Don't do anything. You know...
I mean, they didn't. I feel like they didn't offend anyone. The funniest thing was that they kept getting men in their fucking 70s to announce the awards, and it was absolutely hilarious.
Yeah, Al Pacino's. I think it was also men in their 70s going, I don't want to do what Warren Beatty and Faye Dunaway did and read the wrong name out.
But he fucking did a Faye Beatty. Faye Beatty will do. Faye Beatty sounds like a porn star from the 80s. Faye Beatty your meat.
Faye Beatty and Warren Dunaway.
Anyway, so he comes on stage and he's about 14 meters from the mic and he starts going, wow,
I'm going to start doing Shakespeare. And he goes, to be or not to be. I'm not going to do it. And half the crowd's like, what the fuck is this old bastard talking about? Right?
That to be fair, his missus has just had a baby, and an 82-year-old man not getting any sleep and doing milk feeds in the night.
Are you fucking taking the piss? Are you taking the fucking, as if he's getting out of his bed at 3 in the morning and fucking bottle the beer? Fuck off. No, he isn't.
He's probably getting up 3 times to go for a piss anyway. Yeah, he can stick a bottle in the baby.
He can't even hear the baby crying because his ear's gone, the old prick. Anyway, right? So he goes, right? And you think, oh, cool, Al Pacino, he's still funny. And he goes, there are 10 films nominated for Best Picture, but only one of them can win. And you think, oh, he's going to do this. He's got the format down, hasn't he? He's going to do it. He's getting it. He's going to, what's he going to say about Oppenheimer? And what's he going to say about Poor Things? And he goes, so here we go. My card says Oppenheimer. And everyone's like, what? Right? And I was watching it going, no, this is a bit. Right? And then the best thing about it isn't that, because you think, oh, Al Pacino's just made a little bit of a cunt mind. Maybe he can't be arsed announcing the top 10 films. But the camera that pans towards, I've spoiled an award, but everyone knows.
Yeah, everyone knows Oppenheimer's
one. The camera fucking frantically, right? It's like, oh shit, Al Pacino's just scuffled me here. And it's like the camera pans towards Emma Thomas and Christopher Nolan. And the camera's like, oh fuck, like trying to run towards Christopher.
And Christopher Nolan's like, I'm not getting up on stage until he clarifies his position. Yeah.
So that was good. And then Tim Robbins made an arse of the Best Supporting Actor one. So what they were doing this year, I don't know if they've done this before, I'd never seen it before, but they got 5 of the Best Supporting Actor winners to announce Best Supporting Actor, and they did like a little kind of mini monologue.
Yeah, they did little.
And it was very nice. They had Kehe Kwan and Christoph Waltz, Tim Robbins, Mahershala Ali, and Sam Rockwell. And I can't believe I remembered all of them there.
Yeah.
And they were all saying nice things, and Tim Robbins had Robert De Niro, and he says, in The Kill of the Flower Moon, he shows another side of true evil in an Oscar-winning, I mean, Oscar-worthy performance. And everyone's like, oh, you fucking big dick. He's a big man, by the way. Like
Tim Robbins.
I don't know if it's just because he was stood next to
him. No, he's massive. He's like 6'5". He's a very, very tall man.
4 foot tall.
The hilarious thing is that Tim Robbins is in Top Gun, right? And nobody who's 6'5" can fit in one of those fighter jets. I mean, basically, he would be like just
big enough to be one of the missiles.
He would actually, basically, what they should have is they should have a deleted scene of Top Gun where Tim Robbins has just got his face pressed against the top of the cockpit,
shoehorned into the seat.
Yeah.
But other than that, I actually thought it was a really good ceremony. Other than Jimmy Kimmel, Jimmy Kimmel's a fucking knob.
He seems to have been selected on the fact that he sort of just calmly says the lines and doesn't really kind of...
I'll break that down in a second. So I want to talk about what was good and then just kind of pick on the things that were. So what I thought was good was having 5 Best Actress, Best Actor, Best Supporting Actress, Best Supporting Actors just come on and say a nice thing. Mm-hmm. It was really good. Sam Rockwell was really good for Robert Downey Jr.'s. And I thought that was good. And I thought the John Cena bit was good. I don't know if you saw that.
Yeah, that was very funny. Yeah, I mean, John Cena in the, because it's 2 things, isn't it? It's commemorating that 50 years ago there was a streaker. But it's also quite funny that he comes on, shuffles on naked behind the envelope, and he's giving out the award for costume design. And the first thing he says, our costumes are very important. That's really good.
And then as soon as he gets a curtain draped around him, he goes, and the Oscar goes to.
Yeah,
right?
He's all so happy. Yeah, yeah.
I thought John Mulaney was very underrated. I don't know if you saw that, where he announced best. What did he announce? He announced something. I think it was maybe best.
Yeah, no, you know what? You know what's weird is that while the awards ceremony itself was a bit earlier than expected, but I still couldn't stay up that late because I had an early start. The next day, the Monday, ITV is supposed to be showing the Oscar highlights, but they showed them so late that I'd have been staying up till 1 in the morning to watch the highlights. So I still haven't seen everything. I've YouTubed like big moments, but I didn't
see
him.
Do you know what you're best doing? You're probably best recording that and just fast forwarding through any ad breaks or whatever. But anyway, and I just thought it was a good ceremony, and they did well with the performances of I'm Just Ken and What Was I Made For.
I thought I'm Just Ken was absolutely phenomenal. When Slash comes out on stage, I thought, here we go, this is fantastic.
And to be fair, I didn't want What Was I Made For to win Best Song because I don't really think it channeled what Barbie was about.
Yeah, it's a bit down. I mean, Barbie's meant to be about sort of quite lively energy, isn't it?
See, to be fair, when it was performed live at the Oscars, I was like, okay, Billie Eilish is the fucking shit. Like, 2 Oscars by the age of, 20? That was fair play. And then I just overall thought it was streamlined. It didn't feel like it was dragging. It was, you know, I think it was a solid performance. And I thought this, I didn't notice this until the next day when I was watching the In Memoriam again,
mm-hmm.
because they had Andrea Bocelli and his son singing
Time to Say Goodbye.
Time to Say Goodbye. And the orchestra was lovely, and it had, you know, Michael Gambon saying a famous line from Harry Potter, and it showed you all these actors saying these famous lines and these people that have passed away. And In Memoriam was always a somber moment, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then I didn't notice this because I was so glued to Andrea Bocelli and his son, and also the people on the screen. But she went, my missus, she went, why are there fucking 70 dancers on the stage right now just prancing about? And I went, oh shit. And then I realised everyone was furious about how like insensitive it seemed. Like, why are these people doing this really obnoxious ballet on, well, on the stage?
Everybody's what dead, jazz hands.
Yeah, and I was actually a big fan of the In Memoriam until I saw that, and I went, oh yeah.
Oh dear.
But yeah, Jimmy Kimmel. Just a boring kind of... He's almost the exact same as like Jimmy Fallon and James Corden. Just not very funny, absolutely boring. Just
he's quite bland, isn't he? And I think that's why he's got the gig at the moment.
Well, and he made a dig at Donald Trump, and it's like, oh, fucking hell, man. Like, that was boring. But the one that really annoyed me was the Robert Downey Jr. thing. I don't know if you've seen that.
Yeah, I did see that. He sort of went on a little bit about Robert Downey Jr. It's like, Robert Downey Jr. sort of like went into rehab like 25 years ago now.
It must be coming up for 30, yeah. Yeah. But what it's like, right, okay, the highest point in his career. And Robert Downey Jr. like thinks, okay, I'm getting one of them tonight. Even though, you know, maybe you would expect something like that at the Razzies. Like, I know he wouldn't attend the Razzies, but, you know, kind of taking the piss out of the actor and, like, you know, the kind of mishaps that have happened in their life. But it's when he makes the thing about the highest point in his career. And then Robert Downey Jr. points in his nose and he goes, oh, is that like a drug thing? And Robert Downey Jr. is like, yeah, kind of keep this going. And then he doubles down on that. He triples down and he goes, is that a handkerchief in your pocket or is that just like a rectangular bag or something like that? I'm hinting that he's got drugs in his pocket.
In fairness to Jimmy Kimmel, like, I want that. What they were saying there was, I thought what he said was, you're so definitely going to win the Oscar. Is that an Oscar speech in your pocket or do you just have a rectangular penis? I think that last one was a dig about how it's so obvious that Robert Downey Jr. is going to win the Oscar.
Oh, although, I read that as he was talking about a baggie of drugs in his pocket. Yeah, but it was like,
he did really go on a bit. It's like saying, come on, I think it's like, I've just Wikipedia'd it. Robert Downey Jr. went into rehab in 2001.
Right, so 23 years ago.
Yeah.
But for me, it was like, this is the biggest night of Robert Downey Jr.'s career, and he's obviously wanted to put that behind him for years. You've seen the interview with Krishnan Gurumurthy.
Yeah.
Krishnan Gurumurthy, and Krishnan Gurumurthy sort of hints at it in that interview. Like, he sort of says, like, you've had, like, these kind of things. And Robert Downey Jr. loses his fucking shit and goes, ah, well, the interview's over, like, you know, fuck this. And he's doing it in front of, you know, millions of people when it's, you know, we're meant to be celebrating, you know, Robert Downey Jr. I thought that was really insensitive. And if I was Robert Downey Jr., I would have said, were you not pals with Jeffrey Epstein? And you're standing on stage being really fucking smug, taking the piss out of Donald Trump when you were friends with an actual paedophile, you unfunny prick.
It was a real false note. It's like, first of all, it was a really crap gag. It's like, this is the high point of your career. Well, not the highest. So, I mean, honestly, if he'd done that, that would still have been shit, but he could have moved on from that. But they decided to just keep going, and you just think, I mean, to be fair to Robert Downey Jr., he did give Will Smith a masterclass in how not to react to the host saying something you don't
of
like.
Of course. Yeah, I mean, I don't think that's ever going to happen again.
Because, again, Robert Downey Jr. sat back and went, I've heard all of these lines and I'm going to win an Oscar tonight, so whatever, man. But it was pretty shit.
Other than that, I didn't actually talk about John Mulaney. Did you see he announced an Oscar and he just explained the entire plot of Field of Dreams?
No, I didn't.
It's brilliant. He's absolutely brilliant. So he talks about, I think he must be presenting a script because he says, without writing, we wouldn't have famous lines such as, you're going to need a bigger boat and I'll have what she's having. And my mother spent some time with him in the Amazon when she was researching spiders. So obviously taking the piss out of Madam Web. And then he goes on to explain the entire plot to Field of Dreams and goes, I think Field of Dreams would win Best Picture. But yeah, other than Jimmy Kimmel and a rather insensitive In Memoriam and, you know, senile men being allowed to present awards. I thought it was a really good Oscar ceremony. I think it hit the tone very well.
I've liked what I've seen. So, like you said, we're going to keep our powder dry a little bit about discussing who won and everything. Yeah. The fact is that by the time people listen to this, they've already kind of aware of the winners. But what we want is we want to have a nice self-contained discussion about the Oscars, which is going to be the fourth installment. So enjoy that. Look forward to that. I would say probably not too many massive surprises. There are a couple of things. I think the things that we all knew were actually quite close contests were unpredictable. Yeah, there were a few awards where, like, if it's obviously going to be Oppenheimer, then okay, there's no surprise. But there were some awards where actually it could be this, it could be that.
Yeah.
And those weren't all that predictable. So, and I guess the other thing we'll say is it wasn't a clean sweep. That's the nearest you get to a clean sweep these days, isn't it? Because this is more of the Oscars sharing it out era, isn't it? You don't get people winning all... Like, didn't Return of the King win all 11 awards it was nominated for?
Something ridiculous.
Whereas nowadays, a clean sweep is just winning quite a lot of awards.
A clean sweep is winning five or more now, I think.
Yeah, I think you're
right. Best Picture, Best Director, and two out of the four acting awards, I think that.
Yeah, because Mad Max Fury Road won six, but it wasn't any of the acting or directing.
It was all technical.
Yeah, which is still great to win, but it didn't feel like a clean sweep because it was costume design and it didn't win special effects. Can you imagine it doesn't win special effects? I message you about this. Folks, go away and look. Best visual effects that year didn't go to Mad Max Fury Road. It went to Ex Machina.
Which looks shit.
Now, I like Ex Machina. I think it's a good film. But what Alicia Vikander has on the side of her head, right, is not better visual effects than literally every shot of every scene of Mad Max Fury Road. Anyway, sorry, I'm not get off that. But you're right. That's the nearest I think we're ever going to get to a clean sweep these days.
Yeah, I agree. And I think it'll be good when we get to the big conversation because we've had the conversation about the ceremony. We can just get stuck into the awards, potential snubs or surprises or whatever. So, excited for that.
So I've got a couple of Oscars sort of adjacent news headlines. Obviously, these relate to things or people that were nominated for Oscars. So without discussing whether these people involved actually won anything, I'd like to discuss these stories. Lily Gladstone has obviously done very well ever since Killers of the Flower Moon came out and was a success, and she's been nominated for loads of awards and, you know, won some of them. She's going to star in a film called Memory Police. And this film is based on a Charlie Kaufman script. Now, it's not mid-2000s Charlie Kaufman, obviously, but he's still one of the finest screenwriters who's ever lived. Scorsese is going to be executive producing, so he's basically putting some of his juice behind Lily Gladstone being in another film, which is great to see. And it is it's an adaptation of a science fiction novel by Yoko Ogawa, so there's lots of different influences coming around. And the director, I haven't heard of him, but he did some episodes of The Handmaid's Tale, which the direction of The Handmaid's Tale was always good, even if the show running went offline a little bit. So that's really exciting, because that's Lily Gladstone, who I liked in a film that's going to be completely up my street. Charlie Kaufman adapting a Japanese sci-fi novel is like, yes, please. I will have a second helping of that, in the kitchen, because I'm gonna get through that pretty quickly. You interested in what Lily Gladstone does next? I guess.
I'm gonna talk more about how she did in the Oscars later. Obviously, a few reels / episodes down the line, but I think I wasn't totally sold by her performance in The Killers of the Flower Moon. I was all about sort of the collective cast of that, especially Robert De Niro. I thought Robert De Niro was absolutely fucking phenomenal in this.
Mm-hmm.
But like I think I said in maybe an episode ago or two episodes ago, I didn't feel like she did much. Like, and that's not necessarily her fault. It was just the way the character was kind of written or directed, maybe, but I felt like she just kind of sat there being diabetic and kind of moping a lot. And the only times she really did anything powerful was when she spoke to President Hoover.
Kind of not her fault, though, obviously.
Not her fault at all, but yeah. She's obviously got, you know, ability and acting chops. But I'm not going to say, because I didn't particularly like a performance in The Killers of the Flower Moon, I'm never going to watch a performance again. I imagine I will watch more of her stuff going forward, and it's good to see, you know, a Native American actress, you know, kind of pushing on from here. It is good. But I didn't think Killers of the Flower Moon was necessarily a top, you know, leading performance from her.
Yeah, I mean, I expect her with a leading role in a sci-fi thriller that's going to solve the problem of her not having enough to do. So fingers crossed on that. And the other one is, I don't know if you heard about this, but the script writer for The Holdovers, one of the other big nominated films, the Alexander Payne film starring Paul Giamatti, has been accused of plagiarism. Have you seen this?
I haven't, no.
So a guy called Simon Stevenson, who is... he's got a story credit on Luca, that Disney film.
Oh, I enjoyed that.
Now, often story credit is sometimes someone writes a screen story and someone else writes it into a script. Sometimes you get story credit because you write a script and the studio says, I like the idea, but I think we can do better. And they get other writers to come in and you get a story credit rather than script credit. But anyway, he did that. And he was also involved in Paddington 2, although I don't think he's the main writer on Paddington 2. He's accused David Hemmingson, who wrote the screenplay of The Holdovers, sort of under Alexander Payne's sort of mentorship. Alexander Payne went, I've got this idea, and I've seen this script that you've got that's similar to it. Go and write that script. But this guy claims that Alexander Payne has read this script before and has published this article. Variety published it, and there's loads of stuff online about it's similar, and there's this line by line thing about how similar it is. And it's quite controversial because on the other hand, there is a lot of plagiarism in Hollywood, and there is a lot of, you know, don't piss off someone who's quite powerful, you know, even if they have completely ripped you off. At the same time, a lot of people have looked at this and said it is so tenuous. It's like an older man has to look after a younger person for a few days in slightly sort of thrown together circumstances. Like, you did not invent that idea. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And there's stuff like, there are some similarities, but a lot of people going, God, that it's like one's a hospital, one's a university. There's tons and tons of as many differences as similarities as far as I can see. So I think the main complaint by Simon Stevenson is he did speak to the Writers Guild of America about this, and I think they didn't handle it very well, and they didn't get an arbiter in to just try and sort it out. So he's gone public because he's pissed off that he didn't get any support. But it's probably going to blow back on him. Even if he's right, it's going to kind of, you know, no one likes someone who goes out and makes a fuss, right? And it looks like it's not a done deal that there was plagiarism. But I think that may run for a little while. But it's really kicked off. And a lot of people come back and said, this is not plagiarism. You've really fucked up by going after this. But it's the nearest thing to a scandal over these Oscars.
Okay. Yeah. Interesting. I wonder how that will play out.
Yeah, I mean, I honestly don't know, because it's got a very high profile sort of blast around the Oscars, and then it might disappear, and we might briefly hear about something months or even years later. So who knows? Any other news caught your eye?
No, it was very much Oscars this month, wasn't it?
Okay, a couple of quick ones. Mary Poppins has had its rating changed. I don't know if you saw this.
What, to an 18?
No, from a U to a PG.
Is it because of the kind of language used?
Yeah, basically at one point, some kids are dancing around and said, oh, you look like a Hottentot, which is an old and quite, and sort of, it's not the worst words anyone used to describe black tribes people in Africa, but it's still a bit, it's a word that white people use to kind of dismiss a whole bunch of, you know, indigenous people in Africa. And no one's saying ban Mary Poppins. They just said, you know what, wait till your kid's a little bit older, and if they say, what's a Hottentot? Explain to them the context and say this film was made in 1964 based on an older book. And do you know what I mean? Obviously, right wing cunts have gone mad about it, but most people have gone, I get it. There's some.
I didn't even know that line was in the film. Sorry, I've was obviously a while since I last saw.
No, I mean, it's not a word in common usage now. It's just, you know, if say your kid's at preschool and one of the other kids is doing some sort of, is a black kid doing some presentation saying, oh, my great-grandmother was from Africa and we used to dress like this. And one of the kids has seen Mary Poppins and said, oh, so you're a Hottentot. Do you know what I mean? You don't...
It's very unlikely, but I feel like, they're just kind of covering the base.
And they've not overdone their reaction. It's similar to, you know, if you go on Disney Plus and you go on, like, if you set up a child, like a small child profile, so your little brother can watch the cartoons, right? He watches Spidey and his amazing friends on fucking constant loop, right? But if you want to watch some of the older Disney animations, you actually have to take the child lock off, basically, because Peter Pan's got lots of references to Native Americans, which is how we do it anymore. And it's not saying don't watch the film. It's just saying, why don't you just be in the room when that one's on? Do you know what I mean? I don't think they're overdoing it, but it's just, I think you're going to get these little, this is just a little nudge. I don't think this is a big deal.
I think it's a little bit daft. This is quite a funny story that I like to bring up, but when I was little and you were in a bit of a South Park era, and I must have been about 3 or 4, and my mum wasn't really paying attention. She was like pottering around doing things, and you were
I think either that or you'd worked out how to put cassettes in the VCR and you put South Park on.
Maybe, right? But... And mum didn't really pay much attention to it. She just saw cartoons on the screen and went, oh, cool, you know, James isn't going to be out of my hair for a bit while he's glued to the TV watching cartoons. And then she actually paid attention and it was just like, how would you like to suck my balls? And my mum was like, what? Like, but I think we're kind of like overestimating like how much kids are going to take in. Like, kids obviously take in a lot and were probably smarter and more, you know, in tune than we give them credit for. But I don't remember that at all. Mm-hmm. And I've got a pretty good memory and I do not remember that at all. So I get that they're covering base, but I feel like people are panicking.
The thing is, if you take something from a U to a PG, no one is saying you can't show this to your kid. They're just saying, why doesn't the parent just... It's just a little note for the parent. It's probably nothing, but just so you know. I don't think it's a big deal. The other one that's funny from when you were a kid, because do you remember you used to watch The Simpsons a lot?
Yeah.
Do you remember when Mr. Burns was your favourite character?
No.
So basically, Mr. Burns is a megalomaniac, and most 2 or 3-year-olds are also megalomaniacs. Your little brother believes that everything in the house personally belongs to him. And there was a time when you'd watched a lot of Simpsons, a lot of Mr. Burns, and your mum was telling you off for something, and you turned around to her and said, I'll crush you.
There's nothing you can say back to that either.
No, you got put on the naughty step, but also just so that, you know...
Mum went into the kitchen and pissed herself laughing.
Exactly, yeah, you had to go on the naughty step so that she could keep a straight face. Yeah. Yeah, so anyway, that's that. More interesting, Tom Cruise has signed up for a new film directed by Alejandro Iñárritu.
Oh, for fuck's sake.
Now...
That's going to be a pain in the ass. I just know it is. Like, not because it's Tom Cruise. Tom Cruise is usually good value in his films, but I'm not a big fan of the Iñárritu boy anymore, just because his films are just ridiculous.
It's interesting it's interesting to me because, I mean, I agree with him. You're saying, for example, there's things about The Revenant I really like. There's also things about The Revenant where I go, God, this is a bit of a slog. The cinematography is astounding. There is some striking stuff, but also I just think, isn't he the one who did Birdman?
Did Birdman, which I loved, didn't like The Revenant too much.
Yeah, I think he's very interested in sort of doing quite experimental stuff. But it is always interesting when Tom Cruise takes time out. He's still going to do his blockbusters. But I think my favourite Tom Cruise time period is when he's doing his big Tom Cruise stuff, but he still finds time to do slightly off, sort of slightly left field stuff.
Off-brand, yeah.
Yeah, so that's going to be interesting to see what he does. He's also trying to get a part in the next/final Tarantino film.
Which won't be the next/final Tarantino film. You know
but
what I mean?
Anyway, like but the one, the movie critic, he's interested in being in that. And again, I think it would be interesting. I think it was interesting when Tom Cruise did a bit for Paul Thomas Anderson in Magnolia. If Tarantino says, I've got a part for Tom Cruise... that'll be interesting. And you know that Tom Cruise will absolutely go all out to do the absolute best he can in that, because he's like, yeah, I'll 5 minutes in a Tarantino film, I'll give that my best. And that's always interesting to watch. But very, very, very preliminary news. And finally, a bit closer to home, the city of Sunderland has given the go-ahead for a set of film studios to be built at the Old Pallion Shipyard. so Sunderland could become a new outpost to Hollywood along the lines of Pinewood or any of these kind of UK-based studios that you get some Hollywood production at.
Yeah, I did see that. It's obviously really good news for the area. Sunderland doesn't have a lot going on in terms of things like that. It's very much a kind of your bog standard working class city, which has like you know factories and that kind of thing. But it's good to see a film studio being got there. I thought it was bizarre that the local rivals Newcastle. There were a few people outraged about this because it wasn't built in. Are you building a set of studios in Sunderland that creates jobs for 8,500 people, as if those 8,500 jobs are only going to go to people from Sunderland, yeah, without realizing it's a base for the entire area and probably even Scotland.
And you know, yeah, and Sunderland and Newcastle are like fucking next door, and the A1 goes through both cities. Do you know what I mean? It's yeah, like, so fucking get a life.
Newcastle, in general, I imagine they're nice, but their football fans are a bunch of fucking knobs. I think it's great news. I think it'll be good for the city. I think it'll be good to kind of have film set in an area like that because it's kind of got an underappreciated kind of beauty. For example, Durham Cathedral, that's a great place to be filming, like, you know, any kind of medieval film. So I think great. It's brilliant. I think it's a really good thing. It'll be good for the northeast, even like parts of the northwest. Like I said, you know, Glasgow and Edinburgh could benefit from that because it's a bit of a commute, but if your Scottish film company wanted to film a film, you know, Sunderland's only 2.5-3 hours away, so it's...
Yeah, it's just having the facilities, you know. So, yeah, that's good news, and also it's a sign that, you know, different parts of the UK are getting involved in the arts and you know, not everything being jammed into London, which is a bloody stupid idea. You know, it's good for me because, you know, Stanley Kubrick's got a house in Hertfordshire and one day I'll break into it and have a look. but yeah, that's all the news that I found. Like you say, a little bit quiet apart from the Oscars. Two of the stories were sort of Oscar linked. Anything else?
No, I think that's it.
Okay, next we discuss new releases. These are new films that are coming out basically after March the 25th when we release Double Reel Monthly, and April the 25th when the next one comes out. That's our window for the new films that are coming out soon. Any new releases on your radar, James?
No, I think we're kind of waiting for, you know, June, well, me specifically waiting for kind of like June, July time. That's when the kind of big films are going to come out.
Yeah, I mean, June Part 2 sort of came out earlier than you would normally expect, but that's kind of because it was held over from last year. Have a bit of a quiet early part of the year. There are a few though. This is an interesting one, a film called Mother's Instinct. It comes out on March the 27th. Jessica Chastain and Anne Hathaway. It's a thriller, sort of psychological thriller set in the 1950s or 1960s. They're both mothers in a small, well-off community of kids are about the same age. Tragedy strikes and that rivalry and some sort of tension ensues between them. The trailer looked very good, very sinister when I saw that cinema the other week. March 28th, Kung Fu Panda 4. I'm pretty mad about that. I think, that's done. Come on. I saw a trailer for this. March the 29th, Godzilla X or Godzilla Times Kong, A New Empire. Have you seen the trailer?
Yes.
It looks fucking dog shit.
Yep.
And apparently Godzilla and Kong are teaming up this time. I hope that the Japanese kind of studio that owns the rights to Godzilla is getting well paid for this, because they must shake their head every time the West tries to do a Godzilla film. You just look at Godzilla Minus One, where the Japanese did an actual Godzilla film, where everyone goes, oh right, that's what Godzilla films are supposed to be like. And then the latest dog shit that comes out in Hollywood. This one I'm genuinely interested in, though. April the 5th, Monkey Man. Have you heard about this?
What one, sorry?
Monkey Man.
No, I haven't seen that one.
So there was a point this might have only got like a Netflix release, but it got picked up by a distributor who thought it deserved a release in the cinema. So this should be out on the big screen if you're interested. It's the directorial debut of Dev Patel, who also also stars and co-writes. It's kind of, the kind of offhand pitch is John Wick in Mumbai. It's about a vigilante taking revenge on the rich and powerful for the death of his mother, as well as their general exploitation of the poor and dispossessed in the city. apparently, there's quite a lot of martial arts fight choreography in it by a guy called Brahim Chaab. It says here who has worked on Jackie Chan and Scott Adkins fight scenes, which are basically the best fight scenes. So that, look, maybe Dev Patel's not cut out for directing and writing films, but I'm genuinely interested in seeing how that pans out. April the 12th, Civil War. Alex Garland is back on the sci-fi. Have you seen this?
I've heard of it, but I've not looked into it because I'm not a big fan of that Alex Garland. So,
See, I like some of his stuff, and the trailer looks interesting. Wagner Moura, who played Pablo Escobar in Narcos, is in it. Nick Offerman plays the president. I think Kirsten Dunst is in it as well. It's a near-future dystopia where actual civil war has broken out in America as opposed to the kind of low-level, almost civil war they have today. And in the midst of all this battling, a group of people are trying to go to Washington to try and avert complete disaster. It's one of those films that could either be good or shit. But we'll see. I always like a little bit of dystopian sci-fi about, you know, civil war breaking out. So maybe I'm biased. What else have we got coming out here? April the 19th. Now, I've mentioned this because, do you remember when we did The Harder They Fall? I mean, I discussed it on the pod anyway, The Harder They Fall.
Yeah.
It's on streaming. I think it's still on streaming, maybe Netflix or something, or Amazon Prime, I can't remember which. Directed by a guy called James Samuel. Now, he's also a musician and rapper. He's the brother of Seal, the singer from the old days. And Harder They Fall was like a black western, which had a stacked cast, including Jonathan Majors, Zazie Beetz, Idris Elba, Regina King, Delroy Lindo. And I heard the interview that he did, and he's such a great character. He's doing Al Pacino impressions on the interview with Simon Mayo and talking about how much he loves Sergio Leone. I thought, well, look, he sounds great. Let's watch his film. And I liked it, but I didn't quite love it. I thought it could have been better. Maybe I had overly high expectations. I thought it was decent, but not everything I hoped it would be. But it was enough to make me think, I like this guy. What's he going to do next? Well, this is what he does next. April the 19th, The Book of Clarence. Have you heard about this?
The Book of Clarence, that rings a bell.
So it was shown in festivals in October, and it's already had a release in America in January, and it didn't do well.
Yes, I have seen this.
And it's been a bit delayed. It is a kind of biblical epic, sort of, in which a downtrodden con man in the Holy Land in AD 33, he tries to cash in on the recent celebrity of Jesus by casting himself as the new Messiah. And it's a mostly black cast, so it's kind of trying to do for the Founding Fathers, trying to do for Monty Python and the Life of Brian what Hamilton did for the Founding Fathers. It's a mostly black cast. I mean, look, it's a great cast. Lakeith Stanfield, Omar Sy, David Oyelowo, Alfred Woodard, Benedict Cumberbatch, James McAvoy. And I have to admit, I'm curious to see someone who's had the gall to try and do a story like this in this day and age, because Monty Python's Life of Brian was hugely controversial when it came out, but they came through. There was still an atmosphere where that sort of thing could be done. I get the feeling he's fallen foul that no one in America wants to watch anything remotely, A, non-white, and B, irreverent about religion right now. Or he's fucked it up, but he's made a massive swing with this. I can't help but be curious to see what this film is actually like. So that's why I mentioned it.
Okie dokie.
Is that anything else kind of caught your eye on it, or is it still quiet month for you?
No, it was still quite quiet, I thought.
Yeah, so that's that. A couple of, not many big films, but a couple I think that have just caught my attention and I'm wondering how they're going to be. So Monkey Man I'll definitely check out, and Book of Clarence I'm going to keep an eye out for. Oh, the only other thing is there's an Amy Winehouse biopic. Do you see that?
Oh,
Back to Black?
Fuck off, no.
All of these music biopics at the moment are coming out. They seem to be just so completely by the numbers. To get the music, they're making sure that they've got the permission of the estate of the artist, and it kind of makes people feel a little bit nervous about doing anything too, controversial in the storytelling, and it all comes across a bit safe and tame. So, you know, and given the controversy around Amy Winehouse and her family, in which the documentary accused her family of being part of the cause of her addiction and her problems, but her family needed to give permission for this film to be made. You wonder if it's going to really tell any story worth telling at all, you know?
It'll be a pile of shite.
But there we go. It'd be one of those ones where if you like the music enough, you know, like I wasn't that bothered to go and see the Bob Marley biopic because I knew it was just, you know, I like Kinsey Benadir and I love Bob Marley's music. But I just think that's completely by the numbers. But when it comes out on telly or whatever, I will probably watch it for a few good concert scenes. But I think that's all you're going to get from these biopics. It's all too safe these days. So now we move on to the films that we've actually watched this month. This is any new releases, recent-ish releases, or other notable films that we've watched since we last got together for a Double Rear Monthly. Anything in particular that you've watched, James, that's notable?
I can't remember if I discussed... I've got my sort of films that I've been watching. Did I discuss the new Wonka film?
You mentioned it last time. You said you kind of liked it, I seem to recall.
And then Aquaman, did I discuss that?
Yeah, absolutely hated it. You sent me a picture of you and your dog looking like you'd lost the will to live.
Yeah, so definitely watch this. I watched this yesterday morning after the Oscars. I watched The Zone of Interest.
Yeah, now tell me about The Zone of Interest.
So it got nominated for a few Oscars, won a couple. I don't know if we're going to talk about these kind of Oscars in the big conversation. So it won Best Foreign Film and Best Sound.
Yeah, that was interesting. That's piqued my interest because it won ahead of Oppenheimer. So it must have done something interesting with the sound, right?
Because we're probably going to talk about the kind of big awards, you know, in the snubs. I feel like we're okay to talk about it here. So The Zone of Interest won Best Sound. And it makes sense as to why. So it's set... It tells the story of Rudolf Hoss, who was a real man, a horrible man, who was the commandant of Auschwitz-Birkenau. And he was the first Nazi to decide to use Zyklon B to murder the Jews in the gas chambers on the recommendation of his one of his officers who said, oh, this is a pesticide that we've been using on the plants. Why don't we use it in the showers / the chambers? And he went, yeah, that seems like a really good idea. And that's sort of the whole point of the film. The film is basically, it's a Nazi commandant, a Nazi, you know, sort of commander, and his wife and their children living what seems like a kind of idyllic life in their house. And they've got like a very lovely house with a lovely garden, and they've got a pool, and the kids are very happy, and the mum's just happy doing like just kind of general things around her home. And the husband goes to work, and that's the point of the film. The point of the film is how normal it seems, like the way they discuss things, like, oh yeah, see you later, I'm just going to go to work, the same way that you would say that to your partner, or, you know, someone in your life, and you come home and you go, how was work? And you say, oh yeah, we had a good day, we got this done. That's the kind of tone of the film. It's like, it's not like Schindler's List or The Boy in the Striped Pyjamas or, you know, even like A Beautiful Life, where you're thrust in that environment and you see how horrible it is. It's just the kind of how casual they are. It's like clock in, you know, murder a bunch of innocent people, clock out. That's sort of the tone of the film, and it does that very well. It's a horrible film, and it's not a horrible film, it's a horrible, you know, story that's being told. But it's very well done in that sense, you know, just the kind of sense of normality, the indifference. It's almost like the thing that struck me more than anything is that there's a shot of the commander and he's seeing all the people coming off of the trains. And it's like, when I think of the Nazis, I think of two types of people. I think of the people that were doing it because they were terrified of what would happen to them if they didn't do what they were told by the SS or by Hitler or whatever. And then I think of the people that pure relished in it. So I think of Ilse Koch, who was one of the butchers of Buchenwald, and the people that really enjoyed Dr. Joseph Mengele, the people that were reveling in it because they were absolute sociopaths, psychopaths, evil, evil cunts who just, you know, they will look at this, I get to, you know, test on these innocent people and, you know, fuck them up and do these horrible things to them. So that when I think of Nazis, that's what I think of. I think of the horrible ones and the ones that... And I'm not saying there were more than the other. I mean, the Nazis were nasty people, and the majority of them were rightly convicted of their crimes. Not all of them. That's how we got the NASA space program. But this is sort of in the middle. There's a shot where there's people coming off of the train to be organized into fit for labor, and the ones that are just going to get sentenced to death.
Mm-hmm.
And Rudolf Hess has just stood there, and he's like, meh. Like, it's like... It's like he's waiting for a delivery of stock in a shop.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way he's looking at it. He's indifferent towards it. Now,
yeah.
He obviously has a very evil side to him. He obviously comes up with Zyklon B, and there's a... What the film lacked is what you see more towards the end. So they go for a meeting at a different kind of part. It's not in Auschwitz. It's like all the commandants of all the concentration camps, and they list about 40. It's quite a scary thing where they just say the name of the commandant and the camp they're in charge of, so Sachsenhausen. Mm-hmm. And you know, I could go on, you know, all these ones, and who's going where. And basically the way they're discussing it, they've got cups of tea and glasses of water, and they're all smoking cigarettes and cigars, and someone goes, yeah, we've got 700,000 Hungarian Jews away to be taken on the trains. Each train can carry 3,000 people, four trains a day, that's 12,000 a day, and they're to be exterminated.
Yeah.
And it's like, if we were to have that conversation, we would be like, wait, what? What do you mean that you want us to do what? But they're just like, right, okay. And they're trying to decide who's the right man for that job.
Yeah.
So it's like you're running a project, or someone's, you know, running a shift. It's like, right, so who do I need
to
get
horror
to
of it
job?
Is the horror of it is they're sort of talking about mass murder like it's
like the livestock,
moving boxes around in a factory or something.
And the film lacks a lot of that. And I remember saying this to you, and the director seems like the type of person that wants you to kind of put two and two together. So for example, they don't address the Zyklon B thing directly.
Mm-hmm.
What they do is they show a Jewish man tending to the kind of the crop sort of thing, and he's sprinkling what appears to be a pesticide, and it kind of dusts, kind of goes up into the air, and it kind of zooms in on it, and that's to make you think, oh, is that, you know. But if you didn't know that's what Zyklon B was, you wouldn't have put that together. And I think that was something that could have been put in, like a conversation where they go, oh yeah, why don't we just do this? Oh yeah, that's a really good idea. But talking in the tone, the rest of the tone is sort of like that. It's like, yeah, this is how we need to be more efficient. How do we do that? But in a way that's like, they're not talking about some of the most evil and horrible things that have ever been done.
Mm-hmm.
There's a very, very good shot, spoiler alert, towards the end. I don't know if you want me to tell it, but it is very good, where once the story's sort of done, they go back to present day. So they're showing like the cleaners at the Auschwitz Museum.
Mm-hmm.
And it's... they just show like these women, they're going around them. That shows a woman just hoovering, and she's going past like all these suitcases and all these shoes and all these belongings to all the, you know, the Jewish people that were, you know, they were stripped of all of their, you know, their valuables. And she's just, you know, like kind of cleaning as she goes by it.
Yeah.
And then there's a shot of like, you know, a woman cleaning the glass of, you know, a display of, you know, another, you know, belonging or valuable. And it's to kind of highlight the point of like how normal this was to the Nazis.
Yeah.
And it's showing like, you know, this was just their day to day. And one of them goes in and starts sweeping up the floor of the gas chamber. Which it's today, so obviously it's to clean up after the visitors have been to the museum. But it's the point of that is obviously that, you know, to the Nazis, this was just like another day at work.
Yeah.
That's the kind of gist of it. That's what I liked about it. What I didn't like is that it was very much two and two together. It didn't talk about how I wanted to see a little bit more of how evil they were, because they have these casual conversations. Like he says on the phone, oh, I was thinking about how I could gas all of these people and how I could kill them all with his wife. And his wife goes, yeah, but it's 2 a.m. I'm needing my bed. Now that's a very interesting conversation, because you do get a lot of, did the families know? Did the wives know? Quite clearly they are saying, well, they did know, and they were talking about it as if, you know, would you need me to pick up from the shop on my way home kind of conversations. But, you know, the children of Rudolf Hess were pure evil, you know, very nasty. And they do touch on that a little bit. But I think we need a lot. What I liked about it, I also didn't like, because it kind of showed a sense of, like, the indifference, and I get that as the point of the film, like to the Nazis. Yeah. This was just like, yeah, this is something we just need to do. This is Hitler's asked us to do it, so we're gonna do it. And I get that's the tone of the film, but some of these people were truly evil, and I think Rudolf Hoss was one of them. I don't think he was truly indifferent to it. For someone to come up with, you know, Zyklon B and, you know, talking about the efficiency of killing 700,000 Hungarian Jews, it's a little bit more than just like a guy who's going in because he feels like he has to make a bit of money.
Yeah.
With regards to the technical achievement of the sound is brilliant, and they did obviously do their research. There's not really any score, I don't think, from what I remember in the film. It's very much just the sounds. And basically, you see it entirely from the angle of the family, whether it's the husband, the wife, or the children, and you hear the sounds of, like, occasionally you'll just hear workers screaming in the background, and you'll hear them, you know, being, you know, taken away and stuff like that, and you constantly hear a motorbike that was riding around the Auschwitz camp. And that was actually a thing that Rudolf Hoss said to do in real life, to kind of hide the sounds of what was going on in the camp. So the sound is brilliant, and there's a couple of quiet moments where they have like this kind of thermal imaging where it seems like someone is sneaking in apples to the people at the camp, so they have something to eat. And that's when there's, you know, quiet moments, but there's always like, she'll be in the greenhouse having a cigarette and you'll hear, you know, someone screaming in the background, or there's just constant like background noise of the work going on in the camps, and the chimneys and the trains coming in. And it definitely deserved to win best sound if we're going against Oppenheimer. The sound is tremendous. That adds to the whole point of like, she's in her garden having a cigarette or sitting down having a drink, sunbathing, and in the background there's, you know, there's thousands and thousands of people being, you know, put to death. So the sound, that's definitely why it won sound, and it deserved to win sound based on that. Sorry, I did realise that I spoke for 4 ages there.
No, that's fine. It's great to get a summary of like a film like that. I mean, it's directed by Jonathan Glazer, and I remember we did his film Under the Skin. And it's a long time since he made a film since then. This was, I think, is his first film since Under the Skin. And I remember everyone raved about Under the Skin, and I struggled with it because it was like, I don't really know exactly what's going on here. Yeah. And he seems to have a thing where he tries to, like, hint at what's going on and not make it obvious to you, which perhaps is suited to this story, if you see what I mean. Because, you know, it's like in the same way that maybe Yorgos Lanthimos's The Favourite was the film that made it easier for me to kind of start getting into his films, because I know what this is about. That's Queen Anne. So when it gets a bit kind of Yorgos Lanthimos-y, I can still stay with it. And maybe the fact that we know that's Auschwitz and we know that's Rudolf Hoss and his family, his elliptical style of not being completely straightforward about what's going on sort of works, because that's the whole point of this story, if you see what I mean?
Yeah.
So, yeah, interesting. And I guess credit to the Academy for recognising a film like this, right? Because it's someone doing something new and different and interesting with film. So that's always interesting. I will probably get around to watching it. I have to say, I was, when something contains these horrors, I feel like I have to kind of get ready for it, build myself up to watching it a little bit, but I will build myself up to watching this.
Yeah, it's it left me wanting a little bit more, not in the sense of like morbidness, but I think, is that a word, morbidness? But in sense of, I could see why a lot of people wouldn't understand this film, because not a lot actually happens, and it's not on the nose, it's not, you know, and I get that, and I like films that don't necessarily want to spoon feed you, but it's a horrible film, and there was a few times where I was just like, fucking hell, where they're just, they're having a sit-down meeting and they're discussing, like, the coolant chambers and the heating chambers for, like, their final solution kind of thing. And they're just talking about it like, it's just like a mechanical part of a car. Like, oh, so what does this bit do? What does this bit do? So it's unique in that sense that it shows you that side of the Nazis, because when you think of Nazis, you think of these horrible, you know, blitzkrieg assholes that were pure shouty and aggressive. But there's obviously a couple of moments where, you know, tempers flare, but it is just the kind of calculated, casual, over dinner conversations that they have, and it's like, oh, and there's a bit where he moves to a different concentration camp. This is all true. This is what happened in real life, and he moved into Orenburg, and someone else replaced him at Auschwitz. and then he gets moved back because he wasn't up to the job. He isn't efficient enough. It's like they're getting performance managed. They're getting time targets.
Yeah,
and like quotas
to make
on their fucking extermination of Jews and gypsies and homosexuals and disabled and so on and so many other people. And it's like performance management. It's crazy. It's crazy, crazy stuff. But yeah, I think a very important film to have been made and to watch. And not just one of those films where it's been made to show how bad the Nazis are. It's like, because we've seen them. We've seen Schindler's List. We've seen The Boy in the Striped Pyjamas and Saving Private Ryan and all those war films and how cruel and nasty the Germans were. It was to show that other side, because there's so many layers to it. It's not just kind of black and white and, you know, kind of a binary sense of good and evil. It's just to show the kind of how, like, it was just day-to-day lives of these people. But yeah, would recommend it to everyone who, you know, has an interest in kind of historical stories or history in itself.
Yeah, I mean, that's really great. And I will have to watch it and see if I think the same, you know, because that's it's obviously a big part of the conversation. What did you think of the... Didn't they use kind of thermal imaging at some point?
Yeah, that's what I was talking about. I found it a bit jarring. It really stuck out. So the majority of the film, it is, you know, Nazi-occupied Poland, and they're all wearing the costumes and the house, and you've got the camp in the background with the wall and the barbed wire fence. And then now and again, it's just thermal imaging. And they could have probably done what they were trying to do without that, just because, but the whole point of that is that basically, I don't want to spoil it, but there is a character who is going in and out of the camp, dropping off apples and sneaking back out of the camp, and that's all done in night vision.
It's an act of resistance, because there was a Polish resistance and they were trying to get food to the people inside the camps to try and help them.
No, you didn't need thermal imaging for that. You could have just done that with kind of low lighting. Now, maybe it was a case of, you know, these, you know, we've criticized films in the past for being too dark, but it was very much a case of
it could have been done
in low level lighting.
I heard an interview with Jonathan Glazer about this thermal imaging, and he said that everything else in the film is natural or realistic light, as in it's sunlight, or if someone walks into a room and it's dark, they turn a light on. There's no film lighting. There are none of, you know, they haven't got like the film set lights lighting it up. And he just thought it would look a bit fake if suddenly in one scene you had film light on so you could see what was happening. So he went thermal imaging. But I think with Jonathan Glazer, he does do these things, doesn't he? He does do certain things on purpose that, you know, that are a bit jarring. So it's clearly what he's done here. Okay, well, that's the zone of interest. Shall I do a couple and then you can tee up any others that you've seen?
See, to be fair, other than that, it's just my Year of the Nolan entry.
Well, we'll come back to that then. For me, I did a little bit of a sweep up of the films of 2023. I watched Ferrari.
Okay.
That's available on Sky Movies on pretty much constant rotation at the moment. This is Michael Mann's first film for about 10 years since the unsuccessful Black Hat. It's his biography, or not quite a biography, because it's like one big incident in the life of Enzo Ferrari, the founder of the Ferrari race car and production car company. It's after World War II. It's after his son has died of a rare disease, I think. I can't remember quite what it was. And he's got a wife played by Penelope Cruz, but that kind of relationship's almost just a business engagement these days, or certainly not, you know, not what it was, because he also has like a second family, a mistress and a child that he's got hidden away somewhere else, played by Shailene Woodley. And his company's in a little bit of financial trouble, and he needs to win a big race called the Mille Miglia, the 1,000-mile race, which is 1,000 miles over real roads in Italy, to get people, you know, interested in his cars again, because Jaguar's just won Le Mans. Now everyone wants to drive a Jaguar rather than a Ferrari. Adam Driver plays Enzo. I liked this. It's his best film since Collateral, but frankly, that's not saying very much because none of his films have been since Collateral have been all that good, and it's not up to his best films. It's not as good as Heat, The Insider, Last of the Mohicans, and it's not as good as Collateral, you know? But it is good. It looks fantastic. I mean, he spent years getting all the sets and the costumes and everything just right. The performances are good. It's just, it's fine. It's nothing more. It's quite an interesting story. It's quite suspenseful. It sounds great when the cars are driving around on the racetracks. There's a, I think everyone's seen like a scene of like a car crash. There is a car crash in this, and the CGI on that car crash is a bit iffy. It's fine. It's okay. But I'm not surprised that it hasn't really troubled the awards or anything. I think Michael Mann's done. I love his films, but he's not really... Do you know when there's a drop-off from when they were at their best? This is better than he's been in a while, but still not as good as his best. It's fine. I also went to the cinema to see Madame Web.
Yeah, that was a poor choice.
Because it's part of the conversation, and I don't know. I do like Spider-Woman. I remember as a kid thinking Spider-Woman was a really good character because she's a little bit darker and edgier than Spider-Man, although I do like Spider-Man, and I think, oh, go on then, let's see how this goes. Absolute dog shit.
Yep.
Now, I would say, right, and this would be, I'm gonna mention this point a couple of times. It's got 3.8 on IMDb, and that's probably what I'd give it out of 10. But you have to be really bad to get a 3.8. And it's not as bad as Ant-Man and the Wasp Quantumania, which has 6.1 on IMDb. It's bad, but it's not so offensively bad that I wanted to tear my face off while I was watching it. It's just shit. It's just a bad idea for a film badly executed. Madame Web is a side character from the comics. In the comics, she's an elderly woman. She's clairvoyant. She's blind and in a wheelchair. And she occasionally uses her psychic abilities to help Spider-Man. So Spider-Man says, can you help me? I need to find something. And she tells Spider-Man some things. And then Spider-Man has an adventure. That's not enough for a movie by itself. I don't know why they made a film out of this. And at the beginning, you get this hint, right? Because you see three Spider-Woman characters. Why three? I don't know. I think it's because the Spider-Verse films are quite popular. There's never been three Spider-Woman characters together like this. But fine. Okay, are we going to have Spider-Woman in this film? No, we're not. Those are visions. Those are flash forwards to a future time when a young woman will have Spider-Woman powers. She doesn't. None of those girls have them. They're just three girls at school who a guy wants to kill because in the future they're going to become Spider-Woman and kill him, right? So there's no spider hero in this. There's three girls who might at some point, we don't know how, become Spider-Woman. There's this whole shonky like backstory to Madame Web and that her mum was bitten by an Amazon spider with famously got this strange venom that gives people powers. And because she was, you know, in the womb, she got the powers. 90% of this film would make a reasonably good 5-minute flashback in an actual film. And they've just tried to expand it into a film. It doesn't work. The three girls are just three normal high school girls. Which was a complete waste of Sydney Sweeney. It's like, why have you brought her in to just play a high school girl who needs to be rescued? She's like a rising star. It's just not very good. The CGI is not very good. It creates this huge continuity problem because you have an evil Spider-Man knocking about 20 years before the Spider-Man of the current continuity.
Right.
Because also there's a character in this called Ben Parker. And his sister's about to have a baby. So it's like they've created a world in which you're at least 16, 17 years away from having Spider-Man, and yet New York has already seen an evil guy who looks exactly like Spider-Man attacking subway trains and shit. It's a fucking terrible, terrible, terrible idea.
They need to just not make a film for about 4 years just to reset.
And it's just why three Spider-Women? Right? Because if you want to do multiple spider characters, because to create a kind of spider X-Men, it's almost as if they wanted Madame Web to be the Professor X and to have a future film where there's like future Spider-Man characters. Well, make that film, right? Because this is Dakota Johnson who can sort of see the future a little bit, running around in a pair of jeans, helping three high school girls who don't have any powers. It's like, what the fuck are we watching this for? This is a 5-minute flashback expanded into a 2-hour film. And the other thing that's really obvious, this is a massive missed opportunity, because I know why you've got Venom and Carnage and Morbius, and you're going to have Kraven the Hunter, because Sony wants to hold on to the IP that it, from Marvel that it owns. And it can't make Spider-Man films right now, because Spider-Man MCU, those Sony Spider-Man films basically sit in the MCU, and they can't make any more of them unless they make it joint with the MCU. So they're trying to make these films to create their own spider, like, comic character world. The thing is, right, they've created this problem where you've got Spider-Man villains without Spider-Man. None of those films work fundamentally because they're villains with no hero to fight. Why didn't they make a Spider-Woman film? They've got the rights to make Spider-Woman. I checked this out. They can't make Spider-Man films. They can make Spider-Woman films. They obviously can make Spider-Woman films because they show you Spider-Woman in these films in a flash forward, and the Julia, I think, Carpenter character that Sydney Sweeney plays is the next Spider-Woman after Jessica. So they can show Spider-Woman in films. Why not make a Spider-Woman film? She's dark, she's edgy, she's a bit dangerous. There's a time when she was brainwashed and she was an assassin for the bad guys, and then she comes back to being a hero. You could have her, like, fighting Venom. You could actually have a Venom film where it's Spider-Woman versus Venom, and it's, like, you know, a bit anti-heroic, but sort of not... You'd need better writing they'd be doing, but that would work. But they do this instead. I honestly don't fucking get it. And Dakota Johnson would have been a perfectly serviceable Jessica Drew Spider-Woman. She's the first Spider-Woman. But if you want to kind of... You can't have every character from the comics who's played. Like, there's 5 people have been Captain America. You're never going to get all those in the films, right? So if you want to, like, battle it down, like, let's, you know, boil it down and shortcut, just go straight to Sydney Sweeney as Spider-Woman. She's a fucking rising movie star. You had Sydney Sweeney as Spider-Woman. You fucking got something, right? I genuinely don't understand why they've done this and not an actual kind of comic book movie that might have worked. I know there's a general fatigue about comic book movies, but 1 or 2 comic book movies a year work if they're good. The Batman worked, Guardians of the Galaxy worked. A good film will still work. But this is, honestly, why the fuck? I just don't know why they did it. It's just such a terrible idea. Sydney Sweeney, Isabella Merced, Sylvester Connett are fine as the Spider-Woman characters. You could have picked any one of them. Sydney Sweeney would be my call because she's the biggest star at the moment. If you wanted to do, like, a group of spider characters, there are other, like, non-Spider-Man characters who have the powers, like Silk, if you wanted to kind of have an expanded world. But this is, it's just the dumbest of dumb ideas. I do not get it at all. Terrible idea.
Okay.
And that's that. Now, I did watch The Kitchen. Now, have you heard about this?
I haven't, no.
So Daniel Kaluuya produces and co-directs, but doesn't appear in it. I'm not entirely sure why he doesn't appear in it. It's either because he didn't want to make it all about him. Do you know what I mean? Because this is an independent film with some, you know, more up-and-coming actors in it. I don't think, you know, he thought maybe it would overbalance things if he makes it the Daniel Kaluuya show, but he wanted to give it his name and his support. So how much he actually was sitting in the director's chair actually directing, I don't know, but he is involved in the film, and that gave it a profile. You know, it's on Netflix. It's widely available to watch. It's called The Kitchen. It's got Kane Robinson from Top Boy, a.k.a. The rapper Kano, in the lead. It's an interesting scenario. In the near future in London, all the social housing has been razed to the ground. That future is closer than you think, to make way for property development for the wealthy. There is one place holding out, The Kitchen. They are regularly harassed and surveilled by the police. The police come in and raid them. They're trying to drag everybody out. You know, they're saying this is you're trespassing. You know, this land is the subject of compulsory purchase. The people don't want to leave. They've lived here all their lives. It's social housing. Where are they going to go? Where can they afford to live? There are some rough elements living there, but there's also a lot of community. It's actually, you know, you watch it actually be like a fairly decent place to live. No one's got any money. They're being starved out. So people are going out and stealing food from food trucks to kind of feed the population. Former footballer Ian Wright plays a DJ, Lord Kitchener, who kind of does like local pirate radio, addresses the kitchen every day. That's never not worked, basically. Every time you have a DJ addressing the characters and or audience over the radio in a movie, it always works. You know, like The Warrior, The Fog, American Graffiti, Good Morning Vietnam. Radio DJs always work on film. The main character doesn't sort of believe in the kitchen. He just wants to get out. He's saved up money. He's going to get himself like a little kind of... a apartment. It's all very controlled, but it's better than living, you know, in a place that's got no running water kind of thing. But he encounters a kid whose mum has just died and might be his son. He works at like a funeral place where people kind of get very basic, kind of cheap funerals. And he thinks this kid might be his son. And this kid's starting to fall in with a bad element. He either could get caught up with the gang or he could get caught up with the resistance who are starting to fight back against the police harassment. And it all comes to a head. I thought this was interesting. It didn't quite overcome its low budget. There's some really fun bits where the police drones are kind of watching them all. And then you cut back and see that they're being watched. But it doesn't quite build enough out of that. But it's all right. It's got some good scenes. The performances are decent. It's a little indie sort of... It's kind of sci-fi because it's set in the future, but it's mainly a bit of just an urban drama with a bit of a spin. Decent little film, but I'm going to say this about it. I reckon it's worth watching, but it's flawed. It's second half, it all peters out a little bit, but it's an interesting idea if you like this kind of low-budget sci-fi. It's not bad. It's fine. But I just want to say, this has got a 4.8 out of 10 rating on IMDb. Now, how bad does a film have to be to get 4.8 on IMDb?
Sorry?
How bad does a film have to be to get 4.8 out of 10 on IMDb?
Sorry, I completely misinterpreted that. You got to look at, like, Cats, Madam Web, any recent Marvel...
Well, let's do some films that currently have a better rating than that on IMDb. Ant-Man and the Wasp: Quantumania, as I've mentioned, has got 6.1 out of 10. The remake of Nightmare on Elm Street that we watched for this podcast has 5.2. Morbius, 5.2. Transformers, The Last Knight, 5.2. The Happening, the fucking Happening, where Mark Wahlberg frowns a lot and the plants are taking over the planet, 5 out of 10 on IMDb. So there's no way that this film deserves to be a 4.8 on IMDb. I can only assume that it's more review bombing by racist arseholes. Because this isn't very good, right? And I would give it somewhere between 5 and 6 out of 10. But fuck me. 4.8 out of 10 on IMDb is basically, you know, this film would have to be like dipped in shit to be any worse.
Yeah, you shouldn't go watch it, basically. Yeah, like,
I honestly have no idea what people are saying.
66 out of 100, though.
Yeah, I mean, the Metacritic is probably a little bit generous, right? Because Metacritic says basically 66% of people liked it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Not how much they liked it. It's fine, it's okay, but okay on IMDb is always over 6 out of 10. Do you know what I mean? Okay, IMDb's weird. Not that IMDb scores matter, but it's just weird that a film that's not, it's not a massive studio picture, the people involved in this could do with a little bit of, you know, people watching it on Netflix because it's at least an interesting idea. And for it to get absolutely clattered like this by a bunch of absolute cunts online really isn't right. So I'm having a whinge about it, basically. And the final thing that a new film that I watched this month is Dune Part 2.
Ugh.
Now, this film picks up straight after where the first film left off, like literally, as if they just pressed pause at the end of Part 1. At the end of Part 1, they have this kind of fight that kind of defines Timothy Chalamet's character's kind of entry into the Fremen, which is the local sort of indigenous kind of... rebel peoples on the planet. It literally picks up after that moment. You get a much bigger role for Zendaya as Chani. Christopher Walken plays the Emperor, whose role in the whole plot comes in. Florence Pugh plays his daughter, who has a role in the story. Javier Bardem is the guy who believes that Paul is the chosen one as like a key role for the Fremen. It's basically the second half of the Book of Dune, where Paul Atreides becomes Fremen, starts to demonstrate that he could be the chosen one. He understands their ways. He's got a lot of power. His mum, played by Rebecca Ferguson, becomes sort of venerated as the like the religious leader of their group, and he starts to lead the rebellion and fight back against the Harkonnen, and he's ready to take revenge. Josh Brolin is back. The rebellion comes to a head, and then all the sort of powerful families, you know, and the Emperor come to try and, you know, sort everything out. And the whole universe is essentially teetering on the brink of a huge war. Now, I love this because I really like the book, and this is probably the best version you're going to get of the Dune story, because Denis Villeneuve's a big fan of the original books and wanted to bring it to life properly. He's the kind of person who can do this kind of movie. Hans Zimmer is a huge fan of the book, and he's collaborated very closely with Villeneuve on the sound and the music. when you watch it, you realise it reminds you that the book is more fantasy than sci-fi. This is a lot more Game of Thrones than Star Wars. Do you know what I mean? There's a lot of kind of weirdness and strange ideas and politics, and it's set in the future and there are laser guns, but it's more about strange powers and creatures in this strange land. It's got some interesting ideas and politics. It's got terrific performances from a fantastic cast. You've got Josh Brolin, Javier Bardem, Rebecca Ferguson, Timothée Chalamet he carries a movie. He's going to be a star. Christopher Walken, Florence Pugh, everyone is good. Like I said, the special effects, the sound, the sandworms like rampaging through the desert. It's very intelligent filmmaking. Now, it is going to depend on whether you like this story. It has a certain style and look and themes. Like I say, it's full of weirdness and strangeness. It's not sci-fi. It's like a futuristic Lawrence of Arabia. I found the religion and politics and power stories fascinating, but I don't think that's for everyone. The other thing I'll say is that I don't think this is a standalone film. Part one wasn't a standalone film, so when I was talking about what are my favourite films of 2021, I couldn't really say Dune is the best film of the year because it was only half a film. This is only half a film. You put Dune Part 1 and Dune Part 2 together and make one big, massive 5.5-hour film about weird power and strange worlds in the desert. If that's your thing, this is the best possible version of it. If it's not your thing, it doesn't matter how well made it is. But this is a superbly made film about a story that you are either going to like or not like. That's what I thought. I fucking loved it. But this is kind of, it's fun and interesting that this kind of weird story has made it into like, had hundreds of millions of dollars spent on it to make a big blockbuster film. This is a very, very unusual and different film that won't be for everyone. But I loved every minute of it because I like Dune. So if you like Dune, you'll like this movie.
Yeah, I mean, like you've said, I think it's two parts of the one story. So I think, I didn't hate Dune 1, but not a lot happened. But like you said, it is basically just to kind of set everything up that happens in Dune 2, and that'll set up everything that happens. And I think there's going to be a third one, isn't there?
They are. Apparently, they're going to do the next book in the next film. Now, whether they do that in one part or two, I don't know, but that's going to be called Dune Messiah.
Well, I'll give it a chance, but I'm not going to go to the cinema to see it. I'll wait for it to come out, and then what I might do is I might watch Dune 1 again, and then a couple of days later I'll watch Dune 2.
Yeah, I think watching these films back to back as one big film is the way to watch it. Now, you still might not like it, because it's all about whether you like this kind of weird stuff. People drink the juice of sandworms and their eyes go blue and there are weird prophecies, and it's kind of icky and strange and deserty and weird. I love that. I think it's purely a matter of taste whether people are going to like this film or not. But it's doing well at the box office, and it's 10 times more intelligent than what fucking Marvel are doing. So it's good that it exists, and it's good if you like Villeneuve. It's good if you like Hans Zimmer going to town with the sound and the music. That's what it is.
Very good.
So yeah, those are the new films we watched. What we then do is the resolutions. Now, why don't we talk about your resolution first? This is your year of the Nolan. Is that our name for this, or is it?
It's much harder to come up with a good name for it, unlike the one last year we had about 400 Nicolas Cage puns.
Yeah, so yeah.
Year of the Nolan, I think, works.
Let's do year of the Nolan. So far you've done. We're in the third month of the year, and so far you've done Dunkirk and The Dark Knight Rises. Have you got a strategy behind what film you're going to watch next, or are you kind of is there a plan behind which film you're going to watch in what order?
So I might just get all the Batmans out of the way. So the one I watched this month was Batman Begins.
Okay, so Batman Begins, where Nolan started to become Nolan, but wasn't quite Nolan.
Yeah, he needed these films so he could do the films he wants to do now, basically.
Yeah.
I've been playing a lot of the Batman Arkham games again. I played Arkham Asylum, and I'm in the middle of Arkham City, and I played Arkham Knight last year, so I'm starting to think that I might actually be Batman. when you were a kid and you watched Harry Potter and you thought, oh, maybe I'm actually a wizard. Right now, I think I might actually be Batman, but the doctor will probably just diagnose me with fucking something. But yeah, I'm really into the Batman at the moment, so I thought, fuck it, last night, put on Batman Begins. And yeah, solid little start. I think it's, watching it again, I think I've watched it quite a few times, so it dragged a little bit for me, but not because it was bad, just because I knew what was happening.
But it is very good. Very solid performances. I really liked Liam Neeson. Liam Neeson is it's Ra's al Ghul in the films, but it's actually pronounced Ra's al Ghul. And yeah, good. It's crazy to think that the film's almost 20 years old.
Yeah. I mean, I remember when this came out, and it wasn't a done deal that this was going to work, because Christopher Nolan had done Memento, and I love Memento. It's a total mindfuck film, and we didn't realise that Nolan was going to come back and fuck with people's minds years later once he'd, you know, basically got his hands on large amounts of Hollywood's money. And he'd done Insomnia, which was like, oh, look, he can do mainstream stuff as well. This guy's quite good. What next? And he said he's going to do a Batman film. And it was like, oh, okay. Let's see what this is going to be like. Hopefully, it's bound to be better than the fucking last Joel Schumacher one, but I don't know how this is going to... Do you know what I mean? And it was like, oh, Christian Bale, that's quite a good choice of Batman. It wasn't like, oh my God, this, we're all on tenterhooks, this is going to be the best thing. It was, you gradually got this feeling, he's probably going to do okay with this. Let's see how this plays out. And then when you actually saw it, you're like, oh wow, this is really fucking good, you know?
Yeah, I think watching it now, first time I've seen it in a good few years, I think it's a solid start.
Yeah.
And I think that's the best thing you can say about it, is that it really disregards the nonsense of the 90s and just starts a kind of path. And without it, I think, you know, we wouldn't have the success of, you know, the Marvel Cinematic Universe, because it changed the tone of comic book films.
Yeah, no one was going to get serious about doing big comic book movies.
Yeah, I mean, like, how, you know, Marvel films tend to be a little bit more lighthearted and have a lot more kind of jokes in them. But, you know, you've still got kind of darker, not themes, but, like, you know, I think it introduced the concept of characters being able to die in comic book films as opposed to getting injured and, you know, the superhero saves the day.
And all the stuff that's interesting about Marvel, that they used to find it a little bit difficult, because, you know, Spider-Man 1, Spider-Man 2, they do a pretty good job at that, but the studio's still twisting, like, Sam Raimi's arm to do what turned into Spider-Man 3, right? And then DC does that shit with Batman. And what Marvel has always been about has been a little bit of, it's tough being an X-Men, right? You're a mutant, nobody likes you, you know? In Black Panther, there is the villain has this past that's tied to the main character's past, where you sort of go, well, maybe he's got a point. He was pretty, you know, poorly treated. The people of Wakanda maybe shouldn't have been sitting hiding behind a force field all these years. They could have done more good. No one's interested in just adding that dimension, you know, maybe in a slightly more lighthearted way, like you say. No one's interested in taking things up to that level. You know, even Iron Man, which is a very bright and breezy film, you still have a discussion of the ethics of being an arms dealer in it, right? And no one's taking things to that level until Nolan just sort of presses the button on Batman Begins, right?
Yeah. But yeah, good, solid Nolan entry. Solid start to, you know, one of my favourite trilogies. And yeah, that was my, you know, entry for Year of the Nolan this month.
Yeah, I mean, a couple of points of interest for it. I mean, the Rachel Dawes character doesn't come out very well in this. She's much better in The Dark Knight when Maggie Gyllenhaal takes over. But other than that, it's got some really solid stuff. I think what's interesting is that it draws on original Batman comic book stories, but does it the Nolan way. But it's interesting that it draws on Batman The Long Halloween, and so does the new Batman, with the Robert Pattinson Batman. That draws on some similar, like the Batman Long Halloween and Falcone. It was also the first time that Nolan worked with Cillian Murphy, and now we know how that pans out. You know, the next 20 years, Cillian Murphy just grows and grows in Nolan's world, doesn't he?
Yeah.
It's also a really good example. The one thing Marvel should have learned from this was you don't have to just do an origin story, right? Because this film does the origin story, doesn't it? But it kind of doesn't. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It gives you a flashback. It gives you an interesting kind of new way of doing it, because Ra's al Ghul trains Bruce Wayne, basically almost turns him into a ninja. You don't just get the, let's have 2 hours of Batman just about being Batman by the end of the film, right? You know, that origin story, which is the one thing that I think drags back even the best of Marvel films. How many of them are bloody origin stories? Nolan went, we won't hold you back on the origin bit for too long. I thought that was a really nice move. So, yeah, I mean, you've watched 3 so far. Is this your favourite of the 3? Where are you between Dark Knight Rises and Batman Begins? Which is stronger out of those two?
I enjoy Batman Begins more, but
I still enjoyed them both very much.
Yeah. Very good. All right. Okay, so if you're just gonna go through the Batman, does that mean you're gonna do the Dark Knight next, or are you gonna keep?
I might just
suspense?
Get them out the way. Yeah.
So you think it's gonna be the Dark Knight?
Spoiler,
next?
But yeah.
Okay, very good. Okay, I am continuing with my annual project on women directors. People who've listened for a long time will be aware that the first annual project I did was Yuri the Carpenter. Then I did Stanley Kubrick, and then I did David Cronenberg. And I thought I'd want to, for a bit of a change, do women directors. And, you know, as I said before, it's not that we don't watch films of women directors. There's a bunch of films of women directors, you know, being discussed for the Oscars that we watched last year and all that sort of thing. I just thought if I make a point of watching a few more films by female directors, I will see some films I won't normally see. Probably because you don't get as many female directors doing the genre films that I fall back on a little bit. So it's just a case of, like everything else in this podcast, try and make a point of watching some different stuff, because you'll find something you really like if you do that. That's all it is, really. And I've done Coda and Selma. This month I'm doing Nomadland. Now I reordered things a little bit, because we decided to do for the features a week from now is going to be all Asian cinema. And I thought, where shall I go with that? And Chloe Zhao is Asian. She's Chinese. Although this Nomadland is an American film, I just thought it just about ties in. So we're doing Nomadland, which quite famously, it won Frances McDormand her fourth Best Actress Oscar. It won Best Picture that year. It was a weird year, wasn't it? Because that was the COVID year, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And it won Chloe Zhao Best Director. Now, she went on and did Eternals. Now, I hadn't seen Nomadland. It looked to me a little bit like one of those Oscar-y indie films that I just went, I don't know, will this be for me? And Chloe Zhao went on to do Eternals. I'm still not going to put all the blame for Eternals on Chloe Zhao. I think, you know, it's not like everything but Chloe Zhao's film's been shit, been good, and hers was shit. I just feel like Marvel has lost its way, and Chloe Zhao was... You know, she went from doing, I think Nomadland was like a $5 million film and Eternals was like $300 million. And I think that's a huge jump. But anyway, this is based on a nonfiction book about people who'd kind of lost everything in the 2008 crash. And really the only way for them to live, or a way a lot of them chose to live after that, was to drive around in mobile homes, making their way across America, stopping where they can, hanging out with other people in the same circumstances and themselves, trying to be a bit of a community, and basically living on the road, not having a house. At one point, Frances McDormand's character says, "I'm not homeless, I'm houseless. You know, this van is my home." It focuses very much on how they live their lives, very much on their day-to-day existence and the people you meet on the way. The things I liked about it is it's very atmospheric. It looks amazing. The cinematography is tremendous. And Frances McDormand is always good. She's always watchable. She always makes character really good. And it is a good setting. The idea of this way that people live that you don't normally get, people living in vans, that how you get heating, how you get food, how you get work. You know, they all go and drive to where there's a big Amazon depot, and they work at Amazon for Christmas, where there's a rush on, and then they move on to the next thing. All very interesting. What I would say was this would be a really, really good setting for a story. But this is just the setting without the story, is my criticism. Because really, it is just a film consistently about the mechanics of living like this, and then hanging out together, you know, people play guitar and sing some songs around the fire, and then Frances McDormand moves on to the next thing. I didn't feel like it was going anywhere. Except physically, she was going from one side of the country to the other. I'm not suggesting that there needs to be car chases or shootouts, but none of the characters really have an arc. There's very little in the way of conflict or issues to resolve, apart from the big one, in which Frances McDormand lives like this. There's some hints to the fact that she'd suffered a bereavement and maybe that made it difficult for her to get her life going, but there isn't really the bit where the character says, "This has happened to me, now what do I do?" You know, that bit where people, characters that you've invested in, have a dilemma, and they have to do something about that dilemma, and that shows you who they are. It doesn't really have that. I mean, if giving you an example was, you know, Snapper last year. I mean, that's a very low-key film. I mean, that's nothing happens in that couldn't happen next door to you. Do you know what I mean? Or next door to me. It's people living in a house and stuff happens. But it's about someone who's lost her mum, and then her dad comes into her life, and she doesn't know whether to really let him back into her life, and he doesn't know whether he's ready to be a parent or not. So it's about stuff that actually does really matter to the characters in the story, and you get an arc and you get a story. Sound of Metal, which came out the same year, I felt like that did a much better job of it's a low-key film and it's about people living life on the road, but something happens to Riz Ahmed and he has to go and do something about that. This is just a bit, you know, it's a very, very well done film that doesn't really have a central story. I think it would have made a much better documentary, or would have made a much better setting for a dramatic story that someone wrote to kind of give these characters a bit more to do. So it's very well done. I don't have a complaint. I can't say that was bad or that was bad. It just doesn't add up to all that much as a movie. But I still think Chloe Zhao is capable of good filmmaking, and I would like to see what she does next, is what I'd say. She's very, very good at character and atmosphere, and you know, the cinematography is absolutely tremendous. I think she just needs, for her next movie, to pick a script that's got a bit of something happening in it, is what I'd say about her. Not that she needs advice from me. She's got a fucking Oscar, and I bet she banked a pretty big fee from Eternals. But, you know, as a fan of this kind of filmmaking, I think you're just looking for a little bit more. It did, however, inspire in me an impromptu top 10, which I always like to do with my films that I've watched for the resolution. These are top 10 films about travelling across country. For the most part, these are people trying to travel one way or another over land. You could have stuck something like planes, trains, and more automobiles in this, but it's not so much about anything other than these people are stuck in one place and end up traveling to another, and this is what they find out on the way, is the story. Pretty diverse list. About Schmidt, Near Dark, National Lampoon's Vacation, Rain Man, Harry and Tonto, The Grapes of Wrath, Midnight Run, Logan, Apocalypse Now, Ice Cold in Alex. Now, one or two of those films have a bit more going on than just a road trip. That's why it's about, you know, it's about a big quest from one place to another, and what happens to change people on the way. There's lots of films like this, but I think that's a nice list of 10 for you to check out, any of them that you haven't seen, especially Love About Schmidt. It's a film a lot of people haven't seen. So that's me. Have you seen Nomadland, mate?
No.
It's fine, but you watch it and you just think, God, this is a really nice template for an actual film someone should go and make. Do you know what I mean? It's like someone should make a film about that. This isn't a film about that. But it's fine. It's fine. So that's the resolution for this month. And that is Double Reel Monthly for this month, unless you have any final words to share with the audience, mate.
I don't think so, no.
Very good. That's all for the latest edition of Double Reel Monthly. Thanks for listening. Thanks also to my co-host, James Adamson.
Music was Mistake the Getaway by Kevin MacLeod.
The latest Penalty Shootout film quiz will be released shortly. Next week, we'll be back with our regular features, which are all drawn from Asian cinema. First up will be our Classics and Recommended feature, where we finally get around to watching Takashi Miike's Audition. Then our Hidden Gem, where we tell you why you should get around to watching Korean Cold War thriller Steel Rain.
In The One That Got Away, we'll tell you about Wong Kar-wai's The Lady from Shanghai, and in the remake Hate Watch, we'll look at the English language version of Old Boy. Then a week after that, our big conversation episode will discuss the 2024 Oscars.
We look forward to you joining us then. Look after yourselves in the meantime. See you on the other side.